But first of all, the term water wars, well, we've been returning to it so many times over the past decades, usually, I suppose, or primarily in the context of the Middle East. But Tibet and the Himalayas provide water to the rivers of Asia and a dozen nations downstream. I understand from the guest I'm about to introduce that Himalayan waters serve over one-third of the population of the planet's population, India, Bangladesh, Burma, Bhutan, Nepal, Cambodia, Pakistan, Laos, Thailand, and Vietnam. And as we saw during our trip to Vietnam and Cambodia, the damming of Chinese rivers having a disastrous effect downstream, particularly on the mighty Mekong, and there was very little these countries could do to stop it. Now, China is currently home to more dams than the rest of the world combined, and it has not entered into any water sharing agreements with a single country. So we're going to start with the issue and broaden it out to look at China's growing influence. Brahma Chalani is Professor of Strategic Studies at the New Delhi-based Centre for Policy Research. Brahma's author of Asian Juggernaut and Water, Peace and War, Confronting the Global Water Crisis, and is currently in the country at the invitation of the University of Sydney to discuss this very topic, and he's sitting with me in the studio. Marvellous to have you with us.
Thank you.
How essential are the Himalayan waters for the livelihood of the downstream countries?
First, let's keep in mind why water is a unique resource. People can live without love, but not without water. There is no substitute for water. There are substitutes for a number of natural resources. For example, you can substitute oil with gas, gas with electricity, but water has no substitute. Countries can import resources like fossil fuels, mineral ores from distant countries like China and India importing fossil fuels and mineral ores from Australia. But you cannot import water.
Unfortunately, many people do in silly little bottles, but I take your point. Now, there are river water treaties in place between India and Pakistan and between India and Bangladesh. Is that the case?
Well, there are water treaties between India and Bangladesh, India and Nepal, India and Pakistan, India and Bhutan. The only missing link in the bigger picture is China, which refuses to have a water-sharing treaty with any country, even though it has 12 countries located downstream to rivers that originate in China.
Does it even consult with countries downstream?
It doesn't. What it does to make up for its refusal to share water by treaty, it's willing to sell hydrological data to downstream countries. Now, hydrological data is data that measures flows of rivers, and such data is useful during the monsoon season so that the downstream countries can do flash flood modeling and forewarn their citizens of an impending flood. So that data China is willing to sell, and it does have agreements with countries like India, with Thailand, Vietnam, on selling hydrological data. But this year, it played dirty even on that issue by withholding data from India this entire monsoon season so as to punish India for the border standoff that happened earlier this year in the high Himalayas on a plateau known as Doklam. So without forewarning India, and just when the monsoons were beginning, they decided not to share any hydrological data with India in violation of legally binding bilateral agreements.
Is there not also a UN convention on the non-navigable use of international watercourses?
Yes, there was a. This is the first attempt by the world to enact an international water law. The 1997 United Nations Watercourse Convention provides the basis for managing and sharing the waters of international rivers. Only three countries voted against it: China, Turkey, which is like China, a sub-regional hegemon on a lower scale, and these two countries bribed Burundi, which is a small African country, which was at that time racked by civil war. They bribed Burundi to vote with them against the UN Convention. Now, the UN Convention is now in force. It's now international law. But China refuses to even acknowledge it.
As you well know, we have our water wars in this country. We've got current massive scandals swirling around allocation of water resources in the Murray-Darling. So I'm not sure whether we've ratified the UN Convention either. But let's move on. You argue that there must be a moratorium on big dam building projects while these problems are sorted out.
If the big dams are being built on internal rivers or in any country, rivers that do not flow to another country, then that is the business of that country. But if big dams are being built on international rivers, which are the lifeline of downstream countries, and if the upstream country is doing that without consultation with the downstream country, and doing such construction right at the border, as China is doing. For example, the Mekong River, which is the lifeline of Southeast Asia, China has built 6 mega dams right just before this river leaves Chinese territory and flows into Southeast Asia. When you do that, you are clearly signaling that your purpose is to appropriate shared water resources.
They're weaponizing water, aren't they?
Exactly. I think that's a good description. They're using water as a political weapon to keep downstream countries under pressure and to build the kind of leverage to ensure that these downstream countries will not act against Chinese interests now or in the future.
My guest is Brahma Shalaney, who's Professor of Strategic Studies at the Centre for Policy Research in New Delhi. So I understand that even upstream that it's problematic because the work that China's carried out on dams and in unregulated mining has had very adverse effects in Tibet.
There have been water wars in modern history, but the biggest change in the water map through a military intervention was China's annexation of the Tibetan Plateau in 1951. That changed the entire water map of Asia, because Tibet is known as the water tower of Asia. It is the source of all the major river systems of Asia except the Ganges. They all originate on the Tibetan Plateau. In fact, the main rivers of mainland China, like the Yangtze and the Yellow, also originate on the Tibetan Plateau. In other words, the rivers of Tibet are the lifeline for more than 3 million people. That's more than 40% of the world's population.
I didn't understand that the Ganges wasn't, in fact, fed by the same headwaters. Where does the Ganges get its flow?
That's interesting. The Ganges originates on the Indian side of the Himalayas, but the main tributaries of the Ganges originate in Tibet and then flow into India either directly or through Nepal. But the main river, Ganges, originates just on the Indian side of the Himalayas.
Well, of course, the border standoff between India and China in the Himalayas, which we talked about earlier this year, has led to India insisting on border peace as a prerequisite for developing bilateral ties.
I think without border peace, you cannot have any stable bilateral relations. Right now, the relations are very lopsided in favor of China. China has a $60 billion trade surplus with India. So it's having its cake and eating it too. It is dumping goods in the Indian market, raking in large profits from bilateral trade, and yet trying to strategically contain and encircle India. So India's call is understandable. If you do not have border peace, if China continues to disturb the border peace in the Himalayas, why should India allow China to reap profits from a lopsided trade?
Brahma, let's now look at the national crisis about water within India. It's got a depleting water supply as well as severe pollution problems, and include, according to the Water Project, 21% of diseases in India are water related. And of course, so much water is contaminated with bio and or chemical pollutants.
Water is critical to public health. There can be no public health without clean water. And when water, safe water, is not available to people, it's going to cause disease. It's going to cause people to remain chained to poverty. Water poverty is a sure recipe for economic poverty. And water pollution makes it worse. It is a double whammy for communities.
Some sources say that India is facing its worst crisis in generations in history. Not a single city able to provide clean drinking water through a tap. Up to 76 million people don't have drinking water. What are the domestic causes of this problem?
It's a good question. It reflects poorly on the Indian governments that have been in office, because the priority of any government in office ought to be to provide clean water, provide electricity, and provide basic services to all its citizens. The fact that India still does not provide clean, safe water to millions of Indians, that millions of Indians still do not have electricity supply, does not redound to the credit of the Indian leadership.
Of course, it's multifactorial. You talk about increasing population, urbanization, overconsumption, increased use by industry, a growing middle class that wastes a lot of water on washing machines and dishwashers. There's a lot of factors here.
Precisely. Managing water in an efficient manner has to be a pressing priority. If the same quantity of water is managed smartly, then it can be utilized in a much more productive and efficient way. So the real issue is management.
Off air, you and I were talking about the effects of coal mining, coal production, and indeed coal-fired power stations. It's a hell of a problem where I live, and of course it's a problem in India, mining and coal.
Mining and water pollution are interlinked, because the mining industry is a major polluter of both surface water and the water in underground aquifers. On the Tibetan Plateau, for example, China is not only building large dams, China has made the Tibetan Plateau its main mining hub now, because Tibet is very rich in mineral resources, not just in water, but it is very rich in copper, in gold, in uranium, in lithium, for example. All of us carry a little Tibet in our pocket, because you know every smartphone has a lithium battery, and the lithium comes from Tibet. So this large-scale mining activity in Tibet and its impact on water resources is an example of how mining degrades water, pollutes water, makes things so difficult for both upstream and downstream communities. And the same thing is happening in parts of India. In some parts of India, mining, of course, is very heavily restricted in India, and the Supreme Court of India has banned mining in a number of areas. But in the areas where mining is still permitted in India, the link between mining and water pollution is apparent.
How serious a factor at this point is climate change?
Climate change is a result of human-induced environmental change. If you look at water resources, if we keep depleting water resources, we're going to accelerate global warming because water has a very close relationship with climate. Now, this is just one resource. Similarly, if we degrade land, if we degrade soil, it's going to impact climate. If we accelerate the thawing of glaciers, it'll have an impact on global warming. It'll accelerate global warming, and global warming in turn will further accelerate the thawing of glaciers in the Himalayas and the Alps and elsewhere. At the root of the global warming crisis is the fact that we are leading unsustainable lifestyles. Whether we live in Australia, India, China, our lifestyles have to be made more sustainable. And we are still not at that stage. We are not willing to appreciate that we are damaging and destroying the planet, that we're going to create a planet for our future generations that's going to be a planet difficult in which to live comfortably and healthily.
Brahma, while you're here, I hope you have a chance to speak out against the Adani coal mine project, which, as you know, is proposed by an Indian oligarch and is currently being supported by rather thoughtless people in this country. Brahma, thank you very much for coming in. Brahma Shalaney, Professor of Strategic Studies at New Delhi, at the New Delhi-based Centre for Policy Research.